Welcome to Inspiration and Transformation from the Banks of the Ganga with Sadhvi Bhagwati Saraswati, an American sannyasi living at the Parmarth Nikatan Ashram in Rishikesh, India. Sadhvi is president of the Divine Shakti Foundation, a charitable organization bringing education, vocational training, upliftment, and empowerment programs to women and children. Sadhvi is also Secretary General of the Global Interfaith WASH Alliance and Director of the world-famous International Yoga Festival. Join the musings of an American sannyasi as Sadhvi shares the wisdom and teachings of her guru, His Holiness Pujya Swami Chidanand Saraswatiji.
Welcome, everyone, to Inspiration and Transformation from the Holy Banks of the sacred Ganga River in the land of Rishikesh, India. We'll begin with, how can you keep yourself motivated when the only thing you are facing is rejection, dejection, and heartbreaks continuously? Not just one, not in one sphere, but in multiple spheres. So how do we keep ourselves motivated when we face rejection, dejection, and heartbreak? By remembering what our purpose is and remembering why we do things. If the reason that we do anything is due to some expectation of what we're going to get in response from it, we are setting ourselves up for heartbreak. This is the message that Lord Krishna emphasizes so deeply and in so many different ways in the Bhagavad Gita, that if you are attached to the fruits of your labor, if you are attached to what comes out of what you've done, you're setting yourself up for misery. The only thing we have control over is ourselves. And so if I'm unable to be motivated because what I'm facing is rejection, the question isn't super specific, but let's say I'm applying for jobs. I apply to 50 jobs, I get rejected. Let's say I'm an author. I write 50 articles or 50 stories or even 50 books or 50 poems. I send them to be published, I get 50 rejection letters. I'm a singer, I'm a dancer, I'm an actress, I make 50 videos of myself singing or dancing or acting. I send them off to agents and managers and whatnot. 50 of 50 are rejected. Well, if the reason that I'm writing, or if the reason that I'm singing, or if the reason that I'm dancing, or if the reason that I'm painting, or if the reason I'm doing any of these things is because someone is going to read it or see it and say, oh, that's brilliant, and make me a star, or make me their employee, or whatever it is I'm looking for. If the reason I'm doing what I'm doing is to get the job, to get the role, to get this, to get that, I've lost before I've even sent off the letter. I've lost before I've even sent off the cassette. I've lost before I've even walked in for the interview. Because what I've done is I've put my value, my worth, my life, my happiness in someone else's hands. Now, that's not to say that people don't need to make a living. And if you've got to put food on the table and you've been rejected from 50 of the 50 job interviews you've gone on, that you're not going to recognize a problem. But the problem there is not a problem in you, but it's clearly a problem in the types of jobs you're applying for. Or it's clearly a problem in the way you are applying for the jobs. But this is not something that should demotivate us. We're not living, and this is so important, we're not living for other people's approval and value. And if we are, then we're going to live in misery. Because if they value us, if what we got was not rejection, but what we got was appreciation, well, coupled with that appreciation comes always anxiety about getting it again. One story got published, one poem got published, I got hired for this. Oh my God, what if I can't do it again? Now they expect this of me, now they expect that of me, I'm not up to it. So even if we're succeeding on that level, we're failing ourselves inside. Because what I've done is I've made my value and my worth contingent upon someone else's perception. And this is where, in the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna makes it so clear. Do not be attached to those fruits, whether the fruits are what someone else says, whether they accept it, whether they reject it, whether they love it, whether they hate it, whether the fruit is something as literal as the fruit of a tree growing. You can plant the seed. You can shine the sun on it. You can water it. But there's 100 other factors that have nothing to do with you that could come into play ensuring that that seed never sprouts. None of which is your fault. None of which makes you an unworthy person. But that are out of your control. An example about this that I've shared before is, which I love it though, it's a personal example of this, literal gardening. When I was living in San Francisco, we had moved to San Francisco from the Palo Alto area. And in Palo Alto, we had had a proper backyard with, you know, proper trees and proper dirt and proper plants and stuff. And in San Francisco, in an apartment, we just had little potted plants that you could put on a windowsill outside the kitchen window. And I love to cook. And I was a staunch vegetarian from the time I was a teenager. And so I had learned how to cook. And I loved to grow cooking herbs outside my window. First, I grew them in the backyard in Palo Alto, and then outside my window in San Francisco, and move to the city, plant them. They don't grow. They don't even sprout. Not one of the three pots. I thought, that's weird. God, maybe the seeds were bad. I replanted them. I get nothing. Cannot even get a sprout. And even on something as seemingly insignificant as being able to get basil to sprout, nonetheless, it starts to sting at the ego. You're like, my God, I can't even do this? And especially when you're young, you're insecure, you're, you know, finding your way in life, little things like that even have really a sting in the sense of self. So I'm starting to feel miserable. I've now on my third batch of seeds, nothing is growing. I see my neighbors, they're growing, so it's not the weather. First I blamed the weather. San Francisco's cold, it's foggy. Neighbor's basil's growing, my basil's not growing. One day I come home early from my PhD program where I was in school. Come home early, and we had adopted a cat when we moved to the city. And it was an indoor and outdoor cat, both. And I come home early. Usually I came home only in the evening. It was dark. But I came home early, middle of the day. And when I go in the kitchen to make some coffee, I look out the window and I see the cat in the pots of plants doing this in the dirt. Now, you tell me, regardless of how good the seeds are, regardless of how good the dirt is, how much sun, how much rain, if you've got a cat digging up the seeds you plant and throwing them all over the ground, obviously they're not going to sprout. Obviously you're never going to be able to grow anything. The reason I love this story is it so obviously had nothing to do with my value as a person. So obviously had nothing to do with my worth as a person or even my value as a gardener or a cook. And everything to do with this extra variable of the cat. Nothing to do with me, nothing to do with the seeds, nothing to do with anything except a cat. But if I hadn't come home from school mid-afternoon early, this thing was really starting to affect my ego. I mean, like, you fail at something. And again, I've chosen an insignificant story because even little things have the power to impact us so deeply. You fail at something, even something that insignificant, enough times in a row, and it really starts to erode your sense of self. And this is where the Bhagavad Gita and so many other scriptures are scriptures that don't require you to be a Hindu, are scriptures that don't require you to be Indian, are scriptures that don't require you to worship God in the name of Lord Krishna, but that are so universal because all of us, I mean, at 21, 22, I wasn't religious at all, let alone, I mean, I didn't even know who Lord Krishna was. But how valuable his teaching would have been for me if only I had had the benefit of having it in my life, which I didn't, and therefore had to wait until I showed up home from school early one day and discovered the cat and was finally able to feel okay about my gardening skills. But the same is true in bigger things. There's always another variable. It's not always a cat, but there's always another variable. And so no matter how many times you get rejected, we must never lose our motivation because actually the two things are not connected. And this is one of the most deep and important, I think, lessons of, yes, a spiritual life, but even just a general life. If even just your goal is to be happy or your goal is to be peaceful or your goal is to be productive or creative or in love, we do what we do, not because it's going to make someone else happy, but we do what we do because we've been put on earth with creativity, with skills, with abilities, with initiative, with compassion. And so we use those to act. And whether our acts are loved and accepted and revered and valued and purchased by others or whether they're not, shouldn't impact our motivation for doing them. A flower gives fragrance regardless of whether anyone bends down to smell it. You never, ever, ever see a rose bush that finally decides, forget it. Like, why bother giving fragrance? No one ever stops. No one ever looks anymore. Everybody's on their smartphones all the time. I'm like, I could be a pineapple tree for all anyone walking by me would notice. So forget it. I'm gonna stop. Why use that energy to give fragrance? But she keeps giving fragrance. All of nature does what it does. This is when we talk about dharma. We do what we do because it's our duty, because it's our dharma, because it's who we are, because we love it. And of course, I'm giving lots of different options because the things that we do for different reasons. Some we do because we love it. You may write, you may paint, you may draw, you may sing, you may play a sport, you may dance, even though you don't have enough talent to actually ever be hired to do it, or to actually ever make a record, or to actually have anybody ever, you know, buy it from you or want to hire you for it. But you do it because you love to do it. Or you may do things because they're your duty to do them. You've got a family to feed. Therefore, you pump gas. Or you wait on tables in a restaurant. Or you file papers. Or you do whatever people do. Based on whatever they can do. To make enough money to put food on the table. I don't know anyone who loves pumping gas or who loves waiting tables or loves filing papers, but they love their family. And the love of the family motivates them to pump gas, to wait tables, to file papers, to do whatever it is that they need to do that they wouldn't necessarily do otherwise. Because there's a higher goal involved. So the motivation has to come from something other than how is the world going to respond? Whether it's the general world, like I've put something out there on Facebook or on YouTube or in some public domain and I'm waiting, you know, for lots of people to love it. Or I'm waiting for one person to love it. I've written a poem to one person I love and I'm hoping it's going to make, you know, him or her love me back. Whether it's the world or one person, either way. If the motivation to do it is what those people are going to respond, then we're always setting ourselves up to be miserable. Because eventually they're not going to respond the way we want them to. And then it's going to sting. Because then it's going to feel like I did something I didn't want to do just for you. And you didn't respond. Or I'm doing something that I may love to do, but even more than my loving of doing it is my loving of how, you know, of how you're going to all respond. I may love to sing. But I'm really attached to selling that record. My loving of singing's not enough. I need to find a record label. And until and unless I find a record label, I'm not able to enjoy the singing because the singing becomes a means to an end. And that's where the problem comes in. And this is where it's so important that our motivations become, it's my duty. So, if you've got a job, you do what your boss tells you to do. Whether it's fun, whether they appreciate it or not, because at the end of the day, you're walking home with a paycheck that's feeding your family. Or you find another job. That's duty. Or you do it because it's your dharma. And again, the dharma is not necessarily sometimes the thing that you're doing. Your dharma may be to serve. You know, it's like the story that I tell all the time about the saint and the scorpion. So the saint is saving the scorpion time and time again from the water, even though the scorpion keeps stinging him, because his dharma is to save. Well, his dharma is not to be stung. And the saint certainly could wonder, you know, my dharma is to save. How come I'm always getting stung? But if you look at it deeply, what you'll realize is the two things don't actually have anything to do with each other. The dharma to save, in that case of the saint, follows him wherever he goes. In that moment, it happened to happen in a river with a scorpion that stung him. But it also happened perhaps downriver with someone he helped across the river. Maybe it happened in the village where he took his breakfast to where he's going to take his dinner, in the family where he was begging for food, and when they brought him in for food, he said something or shared something or gave something or taught something or gave a blessing that helped the family. So he's moving through the world fulfilling that dharma. Sometimes it feels fulfilling. Gave a blessing, gave advice, gave healing to a family who touched his feet before he left. And sometimes it stings, literally. Like when it's the scorpion you're trying to save. So it's not that the dharma is wrong, or that the dharma is about getting stung, or the dharma is about getting walked all over, or that somehow maybe this isn't my dharma because look, I'm getting stung all the time. How could this be my dharma if I've got welts all over my hand? But this is where it's important to understand that more deeply. If our dharma is to serve, or to save, or to give, or to love, well, sometimes the people we are serving, saving, loving, giving to are going to love us in return. Sometimes they're going to hug us. Sometimes they're going to kiss us. Sometimes they're going to touch our feet. Sometimes they're going to give us a bonus and a promotion. Sometimes they're going to, you know, do all sorts of things for us. Sometimes they'll ignore us. Sometimes they'll step all over us. Sometimes, like the scorpion, they'll sting us. But we keep doing what we do because that's our dharma. And the third reason, and there may be more, this is just the three that come to my mind at this very moment, is because we love it. It may not be our duty, may not put food on the table. It also may not necessarily be our dharma. But we love it. I love photography. Love to take pictures. Used to do lots of it, don't do very much of it these days, but I love it. And there'll be times I'll find myself, you know, with a camera in hand, just taking pictures of all sorts of things, and somebody will wonder, well, why are you taking, like, why that? You're like, what are you going to do with that picture? You know, because usually the pictures we take are pictures that go somewhere and there's some benefit to them. They're going to go in a brochure. They're going to go on the website. They're going to be used in some way. But the photography that I always did that I loved was just shapes and lights and, you know. You do it and you think, well, what are you going to do with that? Where's that going to go? Well, probably nowhere. But there's a joy in just doing something you love. But again, if I had my motivation of, well, you know, I'm going to post these on Facebook and, you know, the guy from the Met in New York is going to hunt down my email address and, you know, email me and say, oh my God, we have to have a show of your photographs. And then every day I'd be going on Facebook wondering, like, where's the guy from the Met and why hasn't he contacted me yet? And suddenly all of the joy of doing it would dissipate. Why is a picture of some random person getting so many more likes than this picture that I thought was so beautiful? See, you get the ego all wrapped up in it. And you've brought it misery into something that should have just brought joy. And so we do what we do again. Our motivation, circling back to the specific question, our motivation is not that we're going to be rewarded, accepted, loved, praised for what we do. Our motivation is in the doing of it. The doing of it is its own reward, whether because it's our duty, whether because it's our dharma, or whether we, because we actually love whatever it is we're doing. But none of those three has anything to do with how the world responds to it. So yeah, sometimes there's rejection and dejection. Sometimes there's praise. But this again is what Lord Krishna reminds us, is that a yogi, a wise one, a spiritual one, is one who is neither lifted up too high in praise and success, nor one who is brought down in failure. A yogi is one who is not affected, not raised and lowered like the waves on the ocean by wealth and poverty, pleasure and pain, success and failure. And so as we move in our spiritual world, the answer to that is not I don't do anything, it's I keep doing. But I do for reasons other than to get that high of the praise, of the reward, of the love. Because if I love the highs, the lows are going to come. Ask any surfer. Every wave you ride going up, it's going to come down. And if you don't know how to properly ride, you're going to go splat on the beach. And so if we're hooked into the waves that go up, inevitably we're going to find ourselves drowning in the waves that come down.
You're listening to OTRFM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. OM Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single...
Circle of Hearts Radio is a sanctuary on the airwaves. Join me, Grandmother Elia, in the circle on Sunday, 2 p.m. Eastern, as I share information to both enlighten and nourish your soul.
Hi, this is Christina Ricci with RAIN. Every 2 minutes, another American is sexually assaulted. If you or someone you know has been sexually assaulted, you are not alone. Help is just a call or click away through the National Sexual Assault Hotline. Please call 1-800-656-HOPE, that's H-O-P-E, or visit rain.org, that's RAINN.ORG.
Brought to you by RAIN and this station.
Welcome back to Inspiration and Transformation. I'm so glad to have you all back here with me. Pujaswamiji spoke on New Year's Eve of the divine experience when he received his guru's touch. You have also spoken of divine experiences during meditation. What is this like? Are you able to explain the feeling or experience? Also, is it possible for anyone to have a divine experience in this way, or are only some blessed to receive this? Okay, well, I knew who asked the other one. I don't know who asked this one. But first of all, everyone is able to have these experiences. But you have to be open. And a lot of times we think we're open, but we really actually have a very, very specific way in our mind that those divine experiences are going to come, what it's going to be like. And so we're open in that way at that time to that experience. But we're not open to it in a general sense. There's a beautiful story, actually, of a man who is a beautiful devotee of God, really a devoted man. And he was coming home one night, cold winter night, like tonight. And on his way, there was a beggar. And the beggar said to him, "Would you give me your shawl? I'm so cold." And the man wanted to help the beggar, but of course, he also was cold. And so he was in a fix about what to do. And he took his shawl and he cut it in half. And he gave half the shawl to the beggar and he kept half for himself. And that night, he had a dream. And in his dream, he saw God. And I've heard the story told both where God is there in the form of Jesus Christ, and I've heard the story told with God being in the form of Krishna. I'm sure you could tell it with God being in the form of innumerable other forms on earth. And the divine was wearing half a shawl. And first of all, the man was so ecstatic to have the darshan of God in his dream. Oh my God, you know, he'd always wanted this. But then he noticed that God was wearing only half a shawl. And he said, "Well, why are you only wearing half a shawl?" And the divine said to him, "Well, that's all you gave me." And the story has many possible morals, depending on what you're trying to teach. But in this instance, the teaching is about openness. And so in our places of worship, in our mandirs, in our churches, in our synagogues, in our mosques, in our gurdwaras, in our meditation room, on the banks of Ganga, we're very open. Perhaps if he had had an image of the divine in his place of worship, he would have immediately recognized it. But what happens when we're in our quote-unquote regular life is we're not quite so open. And so if you look back over history at people who have had divine experiences, yes, some of them took place in places of worship. But a lot of them took place in other places. My first experience, the one that changed my life, took place on the banks of Ganga. But I didn't know Ganga was holy. I was going down to just put my feet in the river and cool off and freshen up after a long, hot, sweaty trip from Delhi. I had no idea the river was holy. And so, like the man who didn't recognize God on the street, dressed as the beggar, in order to be able to have these experiences, we have to really be open all the time. And so, yeah, anybody can have the experience. And the reason I know that is because it happened to me. And so it's, you know, we may think, oh, well, you have to be a dedicated meditator, you have to be a very sincere spiritual seeker, you have to be, you know, I wasn't a meditator at all. Forget being a dedicated meditator. I had never meditated. What did you see? What did you feel? You know, you'd think within 21 years I would have figured out a way to put words on it. And yet I haven't. And the closest that I've come to be able to explain it verbally of what I saw in that moment was literally, I was staring out at Ganga, and it was literally an image of the divine that came to me in the form of this divine river. Now, it wasn't the image that I would later see of, you know, Ganga. I mean, it wasn't that goddess. She wasn't sitting on an alligator. It wasn't anything like that. It also wasn't the image that in the Judeo-Christian tradition in which I was raised that we're taught when you think about God as sort of this, you know, old man in some ways. I don't even know where that image comes to us. It certainly is not anything written in the scriptures. But if you talk to most people about their image of what God would look like, it's always this sort of old man. And it wasn't like that either. But it was a very, very clear image of divinity. That all of that in my visual field, all of the light, all of the form, all of everything came together to be. But what then happened was, as I moved my head, my visual field, what I realized was my visual field split into foreground and background. And the easiest way to explain this is, if you got a speck in your eye, if you got a piece of dust in your eye, or if you wear contact lenses and you got something on the contact lens, or if you wear glasses and there were a spot on your glasses, as you moved your face, the foreground being that spot would stay the same, right? The spot would stay with you even as you move your head. Background changes, but that spot stays there, right? Because it's in your eye or on your contact lens. And for me, that was what happened with this image of the divine, was it began on Ganga. But then as I moved my head and saw pillars and steps and people and buildings, the background changed, but the foreground stayed the same. And so whatever I was looking at, whomever I was looking at, it was seeing God in them everywhere. And that's as close as I can come verbally to explain what it was like. But I think what's more important than what it looked like is what the experience inside is, because I've read a lot of different experiences of a lot of different people having experiences of God, and they're never the same. And so I think what's really important is that we not have any concept of, oh, this is what happens, this is what it's like. In all of the people I know who have had divine experiences, and all of the ones I've read about, they're all unique, they're all different, they're all individual. And so, but the experience, the inner experience, tends to share a very similar quality, which is a oneness with everything, that suddenly all of the borders between where we think we end and the world begins, that those disappear. And that everything starts to just become part of one beautiful, sort of constantly merging and changing tapestry of shape, of color, of energy, of which we are part. And so the consistent piece of the experience is almost always an experience of the transitory nature of form. And so you lose an attachment to form, because in that moment you have an experience of form no longer being there anyway, and sort of the visual illusion of form. And a deep felt sense, awareness, and experience of being an integral part of it all. And so the form and the energy of the universe being a part of yours and sort of merging and melting into all of this. If you think about what waves look like on an ocean, that would give you a good way to understand it. I mean, that's not for me what it looked like visually, but that would give you a way to understand it, is if you watch the ocean long enough, you see waves and they come and they go and they come and they go and they come and they go. And if you were to do an open-eyed meditation on the ocean in such a way that your entire visual field included only the ocean, not like the hotel on the beach up there and, you know, the kids playing down here, but just the ocean. In a while, what you'd see is you'd see form content, form content. You'd see the water sort of becoming form, coming back into itself, becoming form, coming back into itself, how sort of all of it really was just ocean. And that experience, although not always visually, but internally felt sense, is something that does seem to be pretty consistent between all of the experiences of divinity. And this is what all of the sages and the rishis tell us over and over and over again. In all of the mantras, in all of the teachings, the world is divine. This is what the Upanishads tell us, right? When we read the first mantra of the Aishupanishad, and it says, Isha vasimidam sarvam, yat kincha jagatyam jagat. Well, the whole universe is pervaded by the divine, right? This is, we chant this. The whole universe is pervaded by the divine. There's nothing, no one that is not pervaded by the divine. So it only makes sense that when you have a connection with the divine in any way, that you're going to experience the same things that we're told about. I mean, clearly the rishis had experienced it. They weren't studying it somewhere. They experienced it. And then they wrote what they experienced. And the truth is, when you go to the mystics of all religions, those who actually were writing about their own mystical experiences, not just those who were, you know, regurgitating things that they had heard somebody else say, but those who really were diving into their own meditative practices, they tell us the same thing. Different languages, different ways. But the teachings are all the same. It's all one. It's all God. Get far enough back from the tapestry and you're able to see that it's all perfect and beautiful. And yet, we are a crucial part of it, which means that we have to play our part. And that's where that interesting and beautiful spiritual paradox comes in of, yes, it's all perfect. Yes, it's all God. And yes, we must act. Yes, we must do our part. Yes, we must step up to the plate and fulfill our duty. Which really seems like a paradox. If it's all God and it's all perfect, well, then why we have to step up to the plate? Why do we have to do our duty? Who cares? I mean, why does anybody even have a duty if it's all already perfect? And when you have that experience of being such an integral part of the whole, that's what resolves the paradox, because suddenly it isn't a paradox. Suddenly it's not God's over here who's made everything perfect and I'm over here. And so why do I have to do anything? When you have that experience of being one with the universe, however it comes to you, in whatever form, whether in meditation, whether in prayer, whether lying down and watching the stars, whether watching a sunset, I mean, there's as many different ways for that experience to happen as there are people who have already had that experience. But when you have the experience, what you recognize is that part of that perfection is you and your role. It's like the tapestry is perfect, so who cares if we remove the thread? Well, the perfection of the tapestry requires the threads to all be in place. And only if I'm thinking I'm not a thread would I not have to fulfill my role? Would somehow my actions not be part of the perfection of the universe? But when you recognize how integral all of us are as threads of this tapestry, then yes, it's all perfect. Yes, it's all God. And yes, my thread is crucial. And if it were de-threaded from the tapestry, the entire thing would unravel. That what is perfection is made up of all of these individual threads, of which I am one. When I'm feeling separate, and of which I am all, when I'm in an experience of connection.
This is OTRFM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Do you have time to read that inspiring book or that blog post you've been meaning to get to? In your busy world, how do you improve yourself and keep your life going? I'm Lisa Kay, and my Between Heaven and Earth radio show can transform your life just by listening. Be uplifted with inspiring topics, positive stories, and ideas that really work. Between Heaven and Earth radio is conscious living for your soul, every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Like Baldwin with People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. I grew up loving circuses and other traveling animal shows, but it never occurred to me what life might be like for the animals. Training wild animals to do things they don't understand takes force. Routine discipline with a hook or whip with the heel of a boot shows the animal exactly who's the boss. Don't patronize animal acts. Please contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
757-622-PETA.
Welcome back. This is Sadhvi Bhagavati Saraswati with inspiration and transformation. In general, in a broad way, the only thing we have any control over is ourselves. That's a really good rule of thumb. And if that which we want to fix is the behavior of people around us, let it go to begin with. Doesn't mean we accept it, doesn't mean that we love it, doesn't mean we condone it, doesn't mean that we choose to be near it. But what it means is that we don't bash our heads against the wall trying to change other people. And you can't. You can't. And if you can, the only thing that changes them is energetically. No one's ever been berated into change. No one's ever been guilt-tripped into change. Nobody's ever been manipulated into change. The best that we get through those tactics is we get behavior modification. So they may change their behavior. But if we're really honest with ourselves, it's not actually the behavior that bothers us so much as their motivation for the behavior. So take a simple example. It really bothers me that my child doesn't clean up his room. It really bothers me that my husband or wife or child or whomever doesn't help me clean the house or do the dishes. Now, both of those things are things that really bother me, let's say. I could get, through constant harassing of my children, of my spouse, of my family members, I could get behavior modification. Whether it's because I yell at them, whether it's because I sulk, whether it's because I use whatever other form of tactics I may use to get it, I'll get behavior modification. But the truth really is that what bothers me so deeply is not actually the room or the dishes. What bothers me is it's respect. When my child doesn't clean up his room, what that means to me is I get up every day, I go to work, I bring home money. Yeah, I'd much rather be sitting in a jacuzzi all day long than filing papers or doing whatever my job may be. But I do it to bring home money so that I can buy him the things that he wants, so that I can buy him nice things to wear, so that I can buy him books, so I can buy him toys, you know, however old he may be. And when he pays no attention to the things I buy him, and they're strewn all over the floor of his room, it makes me feel like it's my love and the days of my life, the hours of my days, my energy, my time, that is strewn all over his room. That's not a sweater. That's 2 hours of mom's work. And so when that sweater is crumpled up under his bed, it's my love that's crumpled up under his bed, if I'm really honest with myself about it. And that's why it hurts so much. And so him rolling his eyes and scurrying to clean up his room before I see it because he knows mom's going to be angry, but sort of doing it in one of those ways, you know, with his sister or with my husband or whoever it may be, of, yeah, better get the room cleaned up before, you know, mom sees it. That's not any more respectful than taking off his sweater and throwing it under the bed. I've gotten behavior modification, but I haven't gotten what I really want, which is a show of respect. And this is why you can't change another person. You cannot beat respect out of someone. You cannot manipulate love out of someone. And again, we try, and we get behavior modification. If you only brought me, you know, flowers every once in a while, I would feel loved. Well, eventually, the person I'm saying that to is going to get his secretary to put a note in his diary once a week that something beeps on his phone that says, buy flowers for the wife. But that's not what I want. I don't want him to remember because his secretary reminded him. I don't want flowers that the secretary has to call in. I could buy myself flowers. What I want is that he should be thinking about me. That it should come automatically. So my manipulation, my beating, my insulting, my complaining isn't really bringing about any of the change that I want. So this is why on that level we say, can't change anything but yourself. So with regard to all of our interpersonal relationships, you can say, whether they're family, whether they're friends, whether they're colleagues, whether they're neighbors, whether whoever it is, only change yourself. Never try to fix another person. But when it comes to things in the world, poverty, people on the street, kids without schooling, well, there are things we can do. Now, we can't fix it all. I can't give food to every child on earth single-handedly. Just not enough resources. But we do as much as we can. And it's really hard to know where to do it and where not. And all I can share with you is what Pooja Swamiji does and how he operates, which is basically that which falls in his lap is that which God wants him to take on. I mean, those of us who have been here for a long time, sometimes we smile at ourselves because the number of times that he says things like, okay, no more projects until we've got the ones that we've already taken, like, and then inevitably, there's a new project. Why is there a new project? Because God has thrown something into his lap. Somebody has shown up and has said, God, you know, there's this thing in this school or this hospital or this, you know, village or this river or whatever it may be. There it is. So yeah, no new projects until God sends me a new project. At which point, yeah, it's what I'm supposed to do, because if I wasn't supposed to do it, God wouldn't have dumped it in my lap. God would have sent it somewhere else. And so rather than going out and trying to figure out, okay, what needs to be done, to what problem should we address, It's much more a matter of make yourself available as an instrument. It's like that beautiful prayer by St. Francis of Assisi about make me, you know, oh Lord, make me an instrument of your mercy. I can't recite it all. I don't remember, but it's beautiful. Where there is hatred, let me spread love. You know, it's all that. But it's make me an instrument. Just use me. Wherever there is darkness, let me spread light in whatever way it may be. Whether it's light through education, whether it's light through putting money in the hands of someone, whether it's light through giving them toilets or clean water, whether it's light through planting trees, whether it's light through giving them hugs, through giving them a shoulder to cry on, whatever it may be. Oh God, let me be an instrument. And then just have faith that you're going to be used. This brings to a close this hour of inspiration and transformation. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm so glad to be together with you all each week. And I look forward to being together again next Thursday, same time, on OM Times Radio.